Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to learn about how type 2 diabetes, which we've been reversing for a long time, is now officially accepted that you can reverse it in a, quote, paradigm shift, according to Newcastle University in the United Kingdom, published in the Diabetes Remission Clinical Trials. So they went ahead and spent millions of dollars with lots of people, and they came up with the idea, yeah, you can reverse it. Now, just imagine over the decades how many times we've brought people on the air who've reversed their diabetes. A year and a month ago, we reversed someone that's well known in the African-American community, one of the major activists on social change, Eutrice Lead. 22 years, full-scale diabetes on medications in under 3 months, no diabetes, no medications. Yet it's only today that people say, ah, must be real because it's official. It just takes them 20 years to get up to where reality is, but I'm glad they finally got there. University of Laval in Quebec, a drop in body temperature is linked to aging, and that aggravates manifestations of Alzheimer's disease. This was published in Neurobiology of Aging. So what does it mean? I'll explain, and why if you're over the age of 40, what you can do to prevent that body change and prevent Alzheimer's. Also today, research finds that wisdom is a matter of both heart and mind. University of Waterloo in Canada. And then too much sitting will definitely shorten your life. University of Sao Paulo, School of Medicine. And how much does it shorten your life? Oh, serious amount of years. Wow. So if we limited sitting time to less than 3 hours a day, we would increase our life expectancy an average of 2 months per the lifetime, which are over the years, which means we'd be adding years onto our life. Yeah, that's it. Published in the American Journal of Preventive Medicine. And fresh apple, an apple a day, can keep a heart attack and stroke away. University of Oxford, as well as the Chinese Academy of Medical Sciences. And one clip is from a judge. This was Bibb County Superior Court Judge Verda Colvin when she met with the teenagers. And see if parents, this wouldn't also be good to say to your kids if they start acting out. Our guest in the second part of our program today is Professor Michael Pewitt. He is the Walter Klein Professor of Chinese History in the Department of Eastern Asian Languages and Civilizations and the chair of the Department of the Study of Religion at Harvard University. We're going to talk about what the wisdom of ancient Chinese philosophers can teach us about living a healthier and better life in our modern world. And by the way, his is the most popular class at Harvard University. Let's begin, because we got a lot to cover in this show. I try to save always the best for the last here. So we begin. First up, we all want to avoid, prevent diabetes if possible. If not, then overcome it. And we can through exercising daily. That helps modulate your blood sugar level. By having complex carbohydrates, whole grains like millet is a great grain. Steel-cut oatmeal is a great grain. Also, it contains oat beta-glucan, which is phenomenal. Sesame tahini is terrific. Plus, it has all those special oils, lignans. And then an apple, pears, berries, vegetables, starchy vegetables, rutabaga is good. Parsnips are good. Kohlrabi is good. Beans are phenomenal. They give you fiber, phytonutrients, chlorophyll, and quality amino acids. And then nutrients that can help stabilize blood sugar, like chromium picolinate and B-complex. and helping your heart with coenzyme Q10 and L-carnitine and vitamin E and hawthorn. And also, very important, according to Newcastle University, significant weight loss by controlling those empty calories. And that, quote, can reverse type 2 diabetes. The first finding of a 5-year study has found. This was the Diabetes Remission Clinical Trial, and that's what they came up with. So what they are doing now, which is good, they're not into the vitamins, they don't talk about the exercise or the detoxification with green chlorophyll juices, and they don't talk about high fiber, around 50 grams, but that's all right. They still were able to reverse it with just getting people off the drugs and to get them to lose weight. So good for them. Now you want to go from being diabetic to ideally healthy, you got to do the other stuff. From Quebec, the University of Laval, they have found that the drop in body temperature associated with aging is going to aggravate the main manifestations of Alzheimer's. And we've seen this. Now, why is this important? Because we take it as a given that as we age, every decade of our life, our metabolism, our metabolic activity, begins to be reduced. In women in particular, in perimenopause and menopause and postmenopause, you'll see the metabolism shifting. Sometimes you'll see it shifting so that you feel a little cold in the fingers or extremities like the toes. Where other people might seem okay with the ambient temperature, you might not. And then once you start going through menopause, you'll find yourself becoming extremely hot, having night sweats and or hot flashes, and no matter how cold it is. And then after menopause, you find your body temperature starts to go down. You gain weight, but you're not overeating. And even when you try to compensate with exercise, it still is hard to lose that weight. And that's where your body temperature is coming down. What you have to realize is what organ of the body is behind this? Well, that's the thyroid. Well, shouldn't we be paying attention to thyroid? And shouldn't we tell people what the thyroid does and how to have it be healthier for longer? And the answer is yes, we should, but we're not. So to help people, Dr. Martin Feldman, longtime nutrition doctor. In fact, that's how we began our friendship. Way back in the 1970s when he purchased a doctor's office, who was into anti-aging medicine, and he didn't know anything about it. He said, can I come and sit in your office and watch how you counsel people? I said, sure. And he'd just sit quietly over in a corner. No one even knew he was there. He was paying attention, and that's how he began. But he also became an expert on the thyroid gland. he believed that the digestive system and the thyroid, hence your metabolism, your energy, were intimately connected. He was correct. He was way ahead of his time. So we wrote an article. It's the definitive article on how to understand the functioning of your thyroid, how to protect it, how to enhance it, how if you've had a thyroiditis, if you've had hypothyroidism, hyperthyroidism, any of the conditions, how to correct them naturally. So you can go up on our website and read it. I have over 730 articles I've written. This is not one of the 320 investigative reporting articles. This is a help your body with disease article. So that will help you there. Then you'll get your hormones rebalanced, because once you rebalance your hormones, and then it's more than your thyroid. You have to look at your axis, your pituitary gland, very important, your adrenal glands, crucial, and thyroid gland, and how they all work together. Then your body temperature stops falling. And just give you one tip. Try a serving of seaweed each day. It's easy. One trick about eating seaweed, always soak it, rinse it, soak it, rinse it 3 times. And then you can throw some seaweed into some hot water or steam it, and then you can blanch it, make it cold, and use it hot or cold, and then season it to your taste. But that really will help your thyroid gland, which helps your metabolism, which helps you stop from being cold. And also, if you start using NADH, PPQ, B-complex, vitamin B12, folic acid, vitamin C, coenzyme Q10, and magnesium, that also helps so that your metabolism is not adversely affected. And all that will help you then in the prevention of Alzheimer's, especially if you stay off all pro-inflammatory foods, French fries, hot dogs, pizza, hamburgers, colas, sugar, artificial sweeteners. University of Waterloo, which is up in Canada, they found that fluctuations of your heartbeat may affect your wisdom. According to that new research, this study suggests that the heart rate variation and thinking process work together to enable wise reasoning about complex social issues. It was a professor of psychology, Dr. Grossman, and colleagues. This was based on Australian Catholic University, where they did this, and this is published in Frontiers in Behavioral Neuroscience. The study breaks new ground in wisdom research by identifying conditions under which psychophysiological impacts are judgment, wise judgment. Quote, our research shows that wise reasoning is not exclusively a function of the mind and cognitive ability. We found that people who have greater heart rate variability and who are able to think about social problems from a distanced viewpoint demonstrate a greater capacity for wise reasoning. And the study works on previous cognitive underpinnings of wise judgment to include consideration of how the heart's functioning impacts the mind. And by the way, if you think that the heart doesn't have a consciousness, it does. Now I'm going to bring in a separate study, and I'll tie these together for you. This is from Dr. Fahed Bashir. Quote, during organ transplantation, there have been numerous reports of emotions, memories, and experiences being transferred along with the organ, which is being transplanted from donor to recipient. And Dr. Persol, an American cardiologist, has found 73 heart transplant patients and 67 organ transplant recipients, and he publishes what are called the heart codes. And for example, Clara Sylvia develops desire for chicken nuggets, and green peppers. On May 29, 1988, an American woman named Clara Sylvia received a heart transplant at a hospital in Yale, Connecticut, Yale University. She was told that her donor was an 18-year-old male from Maine who had just died in a motorcycle accident. Soon after operation, Sylvia declared that she felt like drinking beer, something she had never done. And later she observed uncontrolled urge to eat chicken McNuggets and found herself drawn to visiting the popular chicken restaurant chain Kentucky Fried Chicken. She also began craving green peppers, which she had never eaten, and she started behaving in an aggressive and impetuous manner following the surgery. She began to have recurring dreams about a mystery man named Tim. She searched for obituaries and newspapers published from Maine and was able to identify the young man whose heart she had received. His name was Tim. So she visited Tim's family. She discovered that he used to love chicken McNuggets, green peppers, and beer. And that's only one of like 200 cases. And how's that possible? Because there's a vagus nerve, which carries many of the signals from the heart to the brain. And it's found that the brain's electrical response is reduced about half of its normal rate when stimulating the vagus nerve. And the heart appears to be sending meaningful messages to the brain that it not only understands, but also obeys. And this is where neurophysiologists discovered a neural pathway, a mechanism whereby input from the heart to the brain could inhibit or facilitate the brain's electrical activity. In lay language, that just means your heart has a brain. Now, we know that this intrinsic nervous system can be called the little brain in its own right due to its independent existence. For example, the heart's nervous system contains over 40,000 neurons called sensory neurites. And the heart's brain is an intricate network of several types of neurons, neurotransmitters, and protein and support cells similar to those found in your brain and your skull. It's elaborate in its circuitry and enables it to act independently of the cranial brain to learn, to remember, and even feel and sense. So the information from the heart, including feeling sensations, is sent to the brain through several different courses. And these afferent nerve pathways enter the brain at the area of the medulla and cascade up into the higher centers of the brain, where they may influence perception, decision-making, and cognitive processes. So when heart rhythm patterns are coherent, the neural information sent to the brain facilitates cortical function. And this affects the heightened mental clarity, improved decision-making, and increased creativity. Now, how does this all make sense? Well, our hearts have rhythms. And one of the things we do when we meditate is we control the heart rhythm. We slow it down. When we're going into a deep meditative state, yogis are found to be able to control their heart rate better than any other group on the planet. And one of the things that happens when athletes, especially long-distance training athletes, are doing the long-distance training, your pulse rate comes way down. And I remember once Dr. Chiesa, Dr. Khalsa. He was an Israeli cardiologist, physiologist, and he had a center in New York, and he wanted to work with long-distance athletes, and he got my name and put me on a treadmill. It was interesting because the day I was on the treadmill, I was on there for over 2 hours till the treadmill broke. It was at the highest elevation, it was going at a fast pace, and I didn't get tired. He said he'd never experienced anything like it. My heartbeat, he said, was around 49 to 54 beats per minute. And he said, how's that possible? Well, we became friends because of this, and I was up at the Institute of Applied Biology doing my anti-aging research and energy research, and I said, let me show you something. So I had finished my experiments with showing that some people who were able to meditate and bring their body rhythms, including their heart rhythms, down, were able to extend this energy into mice that had terminal cancer and was able to cure the mice. And they did it 6 out of 6 times. It was published in a peer-reviewed journal. And it was the first time ever that you could show that a human's behavior and energy was able to impact an animal in such a way that it reversed terminal disease. And because it was done 6 out of 6 times, and of 50 people trying, 6 were able to duplicate it, and each one of those 6 did it, including a rabbi, Abraham Wiseman, and the head of nursing who would go on to create therapeutic touch because of that. And you can see photographs of them doing this at the Institute at that time. In any case, since that time, I've always put a little pocket on my shirt, and I do rescuing animals, and then I find them homes. But a lot of times I get rescues where the animals have been abused, and it takes a long time, but I always put them in that little pocket when they're young so they can be on my heart rhythm, especially when at night I'm sleeping, they're sleeping, and there's a harmonizing of rhythms. Now, harmonizing heart rhythms means you are transferring the love and the open spiritual connection at the heart level, which, again, has a brain, into your higher consciousness, which then creates a memory of what the heart has experienced. And hence, when we say, you broke my heart, or, oh, my heart is overflowing with joy, or that person has such a good heart, it's not just some metaphorical, abstract, existential, etheric concept. It's real. Hence, one way we could help people overcome depression, anxiety, fear, uncertainty is by helping them to rebalance their heart rhythms, their heart chakras. And through breathing, through meditation, through sound, no one does it better than Shyam Bhatnagar. And this is how you do it. So when I see a study and they're saying, oh, look what we discovered. Yeah, and people have been using this for thousands of years. Glad you caught up. But it means also that when you have an experience, that experience becomes real to you. And therefore, if you were to transplant an organ, those experiences from that transplanted organ are in the memory. Remember, all of life is based on an energy, and the energy contains the memory. So the idea is to take bad memories, recreate, and disconnect that bad memory and replace with a good memory. And we can do that too. So just something I thought, for me, since I work in that field, I found it interesting. I just wanted to share that with you. So anytime you hear someone say, that person's got a good heart, we know intuitively what they're saying. That person has a kind heart. We know what it means. Or someone's got a cold heart, we know what that means as well. Also, to finish up on our health and nutrition segment today, one more little thing here. So we can reverse diabetes. We can improve our body temperature. We can understand that a lot of wisdom of life comes through what we're willing to be open and vulnerable to. Remember, you grow through vulnerability, not control. In fact, control constricts. Vulnerability opens. So we do it just as backwards. Finally, from the University of Sao Paulo Medical School, get off your rear end. A new study finds sitting less extends your lifespan. They looked at research data from 54 countries, and they found in all cases, if you are sitting for more than 3 hours a day, you increase your risk of death by 3.8% from all causes. So if you want to live a longer life, then keep getting up, get a desk that is up, and sit less. And most Americans sit watching television more than 3 hours a day. They sit more than 5 hours a day working on a computer. So no wonder people are living shorter lives. Oh, and by the way, from Oxford University, that apple you're going to eat today, hopefully an organic apple, it's got a lot going for it, including a new study that shows that it lowers your risk of a heart attack and lowers your risk of a stroke. They looked at 500,000 adults in 10 urban and rural communities, and that's what they found, tracking over 7 years, and that an apple a day keeps a heart attack and a stroke away, lowers your blood pressure, and lowers your blood glucose. How about that? And that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine. I'm Gary Noll. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Nice to have you with us, everyone. I just want to play a few minutes of a County Superior Court judge from Bibb County, Judge Verda Colvin, C-O-L-V-I-N, talking with some teenagers. This is not what you experience in most courts in the United States. Please listen. We'll only play 2 minutes.
And the only way somebody will know you're in here is by this tag that'll have your name on it. What do you want to do? That's the question you have to ask yourself. What do you want to do? That's what you might want to start doing. Because listen to me. The way you're going, you will go to jail. Or you will end up in this body bag. One or two things. What do you want to do? Young ladies. Whether anyone has ever told you before, you're special, you're uniquely made. Stop acting like you're trash and putting pictures of yourself on the internet. Stop being disrespectful to your peers. Care about your future. Be somebody. Anybody can be nothing. It doesn't take anything to be nothing. Be something. Do you understand what I'm saying? care about yourselves. The fact that you're shedding tears means you want to be better and you want to do better. Do it. The only person stopping you is you. Do better than what you've been doing. Do you understand me? Do you understand me? I don't expect to ever see the three of you all back in my courtroom like this. One day I want you to come tell me, Judge Colvin, when I got gray in my hair, because I can't even color anymore because it's so much gray, I want you to come tell me, Judge Colvin, I graduated from college. You might not remember me, but back in 2016, you said something to me to make a difference. I am sick and tired of seeing people who look like you and I come in my courtroom and I have to sentence them to prison. And then you hear them fussing on TV about African Americans being in the prison system. Well, guess what? If you don't do what it takes to go there, you won't be a part of it. You already know the game. If you know they come in your community more than they do in other communities, then guess what? You've got a heads up. So that means you got to do what's right, right? Don't let me see you here again. Young man, let me tell you something. I raised a young man as a single parent by myself. I know all the stuff that comes up for you all. I know it all. Been there, done that. Because my son, Mr. Cool, graduated Mr. whatever of his high school. You know how they have kings and queens. He's the king of high school. So you can imagine, I've gone through every experience. Because if you're popular enough to be voted Mr. He went to Mountain Sales, Mr. Mountain Sales, then you know everybody. I'm going to tell you what I told him. Son, I know you're cool and all that. I get it. I know that. I know you're just the man. But what I'm going to tell you, you know I'm a little crazy. So don't come up in this house with any mess. So when folks come at you with dope, this gang stuff, let me tell you, I'm going to tell you what I told him. Pump it. Man, you know my mom crazy. I got to go. I just can't, you know, she crazy. And his friends knew I was, you know, I don't mind going there. And I don't know if your moms are like me. I don't know if they tell y'all this is the real deal, buddy. You better get it together. But I'm telling you, if your moms don't say that, consider me your surrogate mom. Don't you come up in here. I'm sick of seeing young men who look like you all, and more prevalent young men who look like you, white and black all together, coming in this court system, going to jail for something stupid. Get yourselves together. Stop this. Why would you want to be another statistic? Do you want to be another African-American male in a jail cell? Do any of you all want, is that what you want for your lives? Come on. Somebody raping you in the middle of the night, and there's nothing you can do but just lay there. Because guess what? Everybody got to get their turn. So it's your turn, because you're the new meat on the block. That's the reality. And these officers standing here can tell you that even happens locally. I haven't even asked them, but I know it does. That happens locally in jails. So imagine if you go down the road. Jackson has something for you.
Some words of wisdom, and more young people of all backgrounds should listen to that. Now we're going to our guest. I've given you his background already. He is in Cambridge, Massachusetts. He is Professor Michael Pewitt, and he is the Walter Klein Professor of Chinese History in the Department of East Asian Languages and Civilizations and the chair of the Committee on the Study of Religion at Harvard University, and the author of important works on the topic, including The Path, What Chinese Philosophers Can Teach Us About the Good Life. Nice to have you with us today.
Well, thank you so much. It's an honor to be here.
I'd like to begin by asking you a question that might be related to what Samuel Huntington called the clash of civilizations. I believe a subconscious hubris pervades much of Western civilization, and this has been solidified even further with the West being identified with growth and progress and technological innovation and the disciplines that rely solely on intellectual reason. Although there are plenty of exceptions, the average American and European likely perceives our Western thought and values as superior to those of non-white civilizations. We applaud ourselves on the illusion that we represent the pinnacle of human wisdom, and therefore wisdom associated with the remainder of the world has little to offer us, especially foreign philosophers and sages who lived thousands of years ago, unless their names are found in the Jewish or Christian scriptures. And I think this is based upon an assumption that our Western lives are better, more productive, healthier, and more enlightened, or in a New Agey jargon, more evolved than non-Western cultures. And then we look at the facts. and discover this exaggerated perception about ourselves is false. We're the most stressed and depressed, unhappy, unhealthy, overworked, pill-popping nation in the developed world. And our pursuits in life are primarily materialistic. And so before going into specific philosophers and the wisdom they offer to modern Western culture, please summarize what Chinese philosophy in general offers to us in reorienting our personal and social priorities and our reliance upon reason in our approach to life. The forum is yours.
Boy, it's a beautiful question and superbly put. I agree completely. We so take for granted that, of course, non-Western ideas, particularly from the past, what we call the traditional world, by definition have nothing to offer us because, as you said, we assume we in the modern West know what's right. We know how to live our lives. We know how to organize society. So by definition, things from the past are nothing but museum relics, and things from the non-Western world are at best sort of exotic things to look at as specimens, but nothing we could really learn from. And I think you're right. It's a very, very dangerous assumption. And in the case at hand, if you really look at Chinese philosophy, it's not only very different from a lot of our assumptions about it, it really does offer a very powerful vision of how we could live our lives. Let me just give a very, very concrete example. We, if we're putting ourselves in a positive light, think, well, we understand how to live a good life because we know, and we think we're alone in this, we know that we need to look within, find ourselves, find our true self, then be sincere and authentic to that true self. That way we can be a true individual, live our lives the way we choose to live it, rationally decide for ourselves what is best for us. And as long as we're being true to ourselves and thinking about our self-interest, then things will work out for us, at least in the minimum sense of working out for us as we choose best for ourselves. Now, we think, of course, that's right, and if other people didn't think this way, that's their problem. It's really intriguing when you look at some of these philosophers. They actually wrestled with very similar ideas. People came up with similar solutions, actually, in China, and the response from a lot of the philosophers we discussed in our book was to say, actually, these ideas, far from being liberatory, they're actually very dangerous. They're actually very much constraining what we can do. And on this example, what they will say is, well, suppose we're just messy selves, that we're a bunch of messy energies and emotions and faculties, and all of us, all humans, are equally born with the same messy stuff. Now, the way this then plays out over time is when we interact with other people, we expect those people sort of pull out different emotions from us, and over time we form the kind of patterns and ruts of interacting with people. The further argument would be, when we look within and try to find our true self, that's kind of what we're finding. We're finding a bunch of patterns we've fallen into. And if we say, oh, I'm just the sort of person who gets, for example, angry at little things, but I'm also the sort of person who's good at thinking big, well, maybe those are just patterns you've fallen into. Things make you angry because you've fallen into a pattern of interacting with the world that way. And if all of that is the case, then if you try to stick to this thing that you currently are, you're actually simply restricting what you could be to these sets of patterns. And when you think, well, I'll focus on self-interest, you know, what is good for me in terms of this thing I am, well, maybe what you're really doing is not only focusing on this mess of stuff that's become you and not trying to transform it, then you're rationally thinking simply in terms of what is good for this set of patterns, which cuts off from the real way you could grow as a human being, which is how we interact with others. And through caring for others and working with others and developing relationships with others at a local level and at a societal and world, the global level, that's how we become a better human being. So ironically, it's not just that it gives us a very different perspective, but precisely as you said, what it really does is offer, I think, a fundamental challenge to a lot of our assumptions and forces us to look back and realize, well, maybe things we take for granted as being good and liberatory are perhaps in a very counterintuitive way constraining us, even harmful for us, and they would put it very strongly, certainly harmful for those around us as well.
I appreciate those insights. Thank you. Was the world of ancient China, when Confucius and Mencius and Lao Tzu and other sages, different than our own world today, so radically different? And when we face the challenges and threats from climate change and a popularized culture that is frequently filled with rage and dissension and racism and blind nationalism, do we need a counterintuitive and radically revolutionary alternative to the business-as-usual paradigm that dominates American culture today? And then what might you consider to be the most revolutionary idea we can derive from Chinese thought that might be most relevant for us today?
Well, yeah, wonderful set of questions. And let me just begin with the first, which really sets up the next couple. Yes, the time they were living in, we're looking at a period roughly sort of halfway through the first millennium B.C., so these are figures roughly living at the time of, say, a Socrates, a Plato, an Aristotle, a Buddha as well, roughly the same time. And it's actually surprisingly similar in some ways to our own day. So if we think of what's happened to us, we tend to think, well, we are modern people because we've broken from this aristocratic world in, say, the 18th century, where everything was defined by birth and there were assumed ways to live our lives. And now, as that world is sort of broken apart, we choose for ourselves how to live our lives. And we tend to think this is a unique moment. This is what we call the modern period. Well, the intriguing thing is the exact same thing was going on in early China. So they, too, were breaking from an earlier aristocratic past. Those aristocratic societies were crumbling. And very much like us, a huge debate ensued as to, well, then how do we create a better society? How do we live our lives? What are the ideas that really should be guiding us? And again, ideas very much like the ones that we think of as uniquely Western, uniquely modern, actually began popping up. But intriguingly, a lot of them came to be rejected as again, overly constrained. And in contrast, you got very different ideas. And to give a sense, as you were very correctly asking, as to what this would mean, well, some of their arguments were to say, if we are, contrary to the way we often assume, these creatures that fall into patterns and habits, the danger then of focusing everything upon the great individual and the individual seeking his or her own self-interest, the real danger of that is that actually does become a pattern. Like, we can sort of pattern ourselves into thinking that everything comes down to me, everything that matters is according to what's good for me. And over time, they would argue, you risk creating a very egotistical, narcissistic society of people really just looking at themselves and not looking for others. Not because, again, that's who they really are, but from this way of thinking, it's because that's the pattern that they've fallen into. And if you create a society valuing these sorts of things, you can create a society where many people are thinking of themselves this way, and an entire society that could become dangerously narcissistic and inner-focused. And in contrast to this, they would say, well, if that's one pattern, what would happen if we developed different patterns? Patterns based on caring, compassion, connecting with others, and concretely, how would we do that? How do we actually break these patterns that we fall into in dangerous ways? In our case, I think perhaps a tendency toward extreme narcissism, etc. And how do we actively break out of these? And this is really their main concern. It's to say, look at any given moment at what the dangerous patterns are that we're falling into, and ask concretely, how could we break these? And how do we develop better dispositions and better ways of relating to us, to those around us? And yes, I think for the current moment we're living in, it's a very, very valuable and very powerful vision of what we could instead be doing.
One of the principal foundations that I personally find intriguing about Eastern philosophy is that of change, that life around us is a constant flux, including our own lives. And this is something difficult for many Westerners to accept. We find comfort in believing life is stable. If I make enough money, I'll find stability and won't become a victim of the ups and downs of the economy, for example. And we also regard ourselves and our personalities as fixed entities. People have a lot of trouble with personal change. And I confront this constantly as a person dealing with people and trying to assist them in changing their lifestyles, even when that change means they might live or overcome disease or improve their health. They fight it. So what do some of the Chinese philosophers, such as Confucius, teach us about the constant flux and change in our environment, and how might we let go of clinging on to the idea of life as stable and our personal selves as static, unchanging entities?
Yes, that is beautifully put, and they would agree completely. One of our fundamental dangers is that we do tend to like the idea that we are stable selves, as you said, living in a stable world. And if these Chinese philosophers, are right, that we fall into these patterns and ruts, what this means is that we tend to get very comfortable in our patterns and ruts. And a lot of the very typically American ways of talking about the self actually kind of reinforce this idea. And so you'll often hear people say, well, I realize I'm not very happy and things aren't going well for me. But then when you said, concretely say, well, why don't you change things you're doing and why don't you alter things? You'll often hear responses back, well, but this is just me. It's just who I am, and I should love myself for who I am. Well, why? Why should we love ourselves for this current set of patterns and ruts we've fallen into? Why shouldn't the focus be to alter the self and change the self? And as you said, the same thing is true when we're thinking about our society in general and our future lives. We tend to think, well, if I'm doing what's best for me and making good rational plans for how I can succeed in this world, I'm assuming a pretty stable world. I'm assuming that things will go as I largely predict them, that my success can be defined in terms of very stable things, so you know, money, fame, etc. And moreover, those will enhance me because I just am the stable person who is doing the things that are best for me. Now, as you said, a lot of our philosophers from China would say every single one of those views is both wrong and perhaps even more importantly, dangerous. So we're not stable selves. We're scared of the thought that we're not, but we're not. And to the degree to which we are is the degree to which we simply have fallen into these patterns that we can't break out of, but we need to break out of them because that's the only way we can grow. And the world around us is not stable. It equally consists of endless numbers of messy people and messy things. And that's a very disturbing thought to realize, well, I can't control everything that's going to be happening to me. But of course, the precise flip side of a vision of endless flux is it's also incredibly opening. Very scary, but it means huge numbers of things are possible that we can't even imagine. And concretely, therefore, what they would say is never say, oh, I just am who I am, and I should just accept who I am and accept what's happening to me and accept how I feel about the world and accept my, for example, bad relationships, etc., because that's just me. No. The goal is always to break these patterns, to overcome these very dangerous patterns we fall into, and to break from our way of thinking that rationally I can figure out a life plan based upon an assumed stable world. So it's all about breaking patterns, breaking our tendency to believe in stability, and opening ourselves up to the possibility of change, changing ourselves, and working with what is, in fact, a very capricious world. But again, capricious goes both ways. It's scary, but it means there's endless room for possible change.
And I just have one final question for you. I recall a survey decades ago, back in the early 1970s, of students across many U.S. campuses who were asked why they were attending college And at that time, approximately 75% of college students said they were there to pursue personal interests, learn more about themselves, and learn about the world. The remaining 25% said they were in college solely to pursue a future career. That same survey, performed again about 10 years ago, found just the opposite. 75% were in college to jump into a lucrative career after graduation. Consequently, they look at education as very pragmatic and not particularly experimental or exploratory. And this indicates to me that many young people have a very fixed, narrow plan that they want to follow. And I would also say that this also represents a very narrow, fixed view about themselves as well. And also parents today are equally forcing children into this very fixed, narrow view of life that career is all that's important. And personally, I feel that this has contributed to a lack of some of the critical thinking skills in many of the younger generation that we didn't have in the past. If you think of great social critics like Professor Henry Giroux of McMaster's University, we're not seeing that today. So how would the Chinese sages address this dominant trend that defines so much of our civilization today?
I agree with you completely. This has become so pervasive now that the way I can make it ahead in life is to be completely focused on my career, figuring out what is best for me. I'm thinking of everything in a purely utilitarian calculus to get me these great things, great career, great wealth, great fame, etc. And the idea is we should really organize our lives, including, you know, concretely in a college, organize our entire course structures, our activities, in order to push ourselves quickly into that career path. And we think, well, of course, that might not be good for in the sense of creating a broader individual, but maybe that's good in terms of, for example, getting that career. Ironically, I think it's the exact opposite. Ironically, when one thinks that one is a stable self, that one can just direct oneself toward a very clear, stable goal and direct all of one's energies that way, actually what you're really doing is boxing yourself in. You're constraining yourself. You're constraining what you could be doing. And since, again, we fall into these patterns and ruts in our lives, that approach really means you end up, in practice, cutting yourself off from all the possibilities that could have otherwise been opening up to you, cutting yourself off from the ability to really train yourself through these other experiences to see things that otherwise you wouldn't have seen on both a daily basis, but also a larger basis too. And it becomes a daily practice of being so focused that ironically it's horribly self-destructive. So here too, our philosophers would say, no, your goal is to break these patterns. Open yourself up. Do things that open up toward much, much more complex ways of thinking, much more complex ways of experiencing the world, realizing that is how you grow as a human being. And ironically, even in terms of things like our careers, you'll be an incomparably happier and, in the long run, much more productive person because you'll be so much more able to act and engage in the world because you'll be developing the skills to do so. And you'll be finding the very complex, different sides of yourself that otherwise you wouldn't know even existed because we're so focused on, de facto, cutting those off as we try with our stable selves to run ahead in life.
Very important. The book is called The Path, What Chinese Philosophers Can Teach Us About the Good Life. My guest, Professor Micah Puett, P-U-E-T-T. He is the Walter Klein Professor of Chinese History in the Department of East Asian Languages and Civilizations and the chair of the Committee on the Study of Religion at Harvard University. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you so much. It's been a tremendous pleasure.
I'm Gary Knoll, and I want to thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more on our next program.